You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. He'll be back next week. Coming up, an island in New York State was returned to the Stockbridge Muncie Band of Mohican Indians in Wisconsin earlier this year. We'll learn about the history of the land and how it made its way back to the community. Now, over the holiday weekend, hackers targeted the networks of at least 1,500 businesses and organizations worldwide. They got in through IT management software Kaseya. For a $70 million Bitcoin ransom, they will unlock the compromised data. Last month, President Biden told Russian President Vladimir Putin that there would be consequences if he turned a blind eye to Russian hackers that attack U.S. cyber infrastructure. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Has your workplace been hit with a ransomware attack? Let us know what happened. Did the federal government provide any support? And if you work in IT, how is your department trying to thwart these attacks? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Eric Geller is a cybersecurity reporter at Politico, and he covers federal cyber policy issues. Eric, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, JC.
So what do we know about the hackers who are behind this recent attack?
What we know is that they are a pretty prolific ransomware gang called Revil, R-E-V-I-L. They've been responsible for a number of high-profile ransomware attacks, and they have just joined the litany of groups that have gotten quite a lot of perhaps unwanted publicity. That would also include the Dark Side gang that attacked Colonial Pipeline a few months ago. This is really the time where a lot of these groups are stepping out of the shadows and starting to make even more of a name for themselves than they already were.
So from what I've read, this Revil group, it's a Russian language group, a little unclear if they're in Eastern Europe or in Russia itself. But when we've talked about cybersecurity issues in the past, you know, we've talked about some state-sanctioned cybersecurity attacks. Insofar as we know, is this group affiliated with the Russian government, or are they just out there working on their own?
So the best information we have is that they are working on their own. There are, of course, cyber criminals who sort of moonlight and provide their services for the Russian government on some occasions. There's sort of a nexus there. But this group, like the Dark Side group, is believed to be an independent operator.
So do we have a sense as to why Kaseya was targeted specifically?
We don't know exactly what the hackers were going for. However, I will say it's a pretty great target if you want to have a lot of spillover effects, as we've seen with this attack. They basically make software that companies buy, and then those companies go to other companies and say, hey, we will manage your networks. We will protect your data. And the way we do that is by buying this software from a company called Kaseya. So what you have here is not only Kaseya itself being hacked, but the companies who buy the management software, and then any companies that contract with those companies. So there's sort of three levels of damage that you can imagine here, not too dissimilar from the SolarWinds attack. SolarWinds was also a company that sold this kind of management software. This software has incredibly broad access to the networks that it's placed on because it needs to scan for threats. So this is some of the best software to compromise if you want to really get deep into somebody's network.
And it sounds like instead of targeting one big thing like the Colonial Pipeline, that it did have a cascading effect, that it affected businesses like grocery stores in Sweden. And I feel like I read that some schools in New Zealand were also impacted. You know, how does this kind of undercut some of our confidence in the software that we use? Because, you know, one grocery store in Sweden is not necessarily the same thing as a big target.
It's a huge challenge, and it highlights work that cybersecurity experts have been doing for years to try to increase trust in our software and create programs sort of like the Energy Star label to help companies, before they buy a piece of software, understand how safe it is. Has it been certified? Has it passed any sort of government or nonprofit testing regimes. This is an effort that President Biden has kickstarted with his executive order. He wants to create pilot programs to create some kind of cybersecurity labeling system for software. And he's going to be directing federal agencies to essentially change the language that they use for their own contracts so that they're only going to be buying software that has gone through certain tests. And the idea there is to use the power of the federal government to change the market so that all of a sudden all kinds of companies start designing their software with security in mind because they want to be federal contractees someday. They want to get federal contracts. It's a big market. This is the only way right now without legislative action that the Biden administration can sort of weigh in here. It cannot force companies to meet security requirements except if they are doing so through federal contracts. So that's one aspect of this that we're seeing a lot of right now is an attempt to create a better understanding of what kind of code is in our software so that we can know if it's safe or not.
So this attack on Kaseya software was done, and please correct me if I'm wrong, it was done through a patch. They were able to get into the software itself. How frequent is that a way for hackers to conduct these cyber attacks?
It does happen. It happened with SolarWinds that the hackers were able to modify a piece of the code when it went out to SolarWinds customers. So it does happen sometimes. However, I will say, especially with ransomware, the much more frequent attack vector is sending somebody malware that then locks up their computers, you know, through an email attachment or a text message attachment, for example. What we're seeing in this case is that cyber criminals are starting to use more of the tactics that we associate with really advanced hackers, government-sponsored hackers. And, you know, the Justice Department has been warning for years about this kind of blended threat of cyber crime and nation-state espionage merging. We're seeing a version of that here in terms of these criminals getting a little bit more sophisticated about how they go about their business.
We are talking to Eric Geller right now. He's a cybersecurity reporter at Politico, and he covers federal cyber policy issues. And, you know, one thing you just said was that the Justice Department has been on their radar for a while. We have now had, if it's been on the radar for a while, we've had these really significant cybersecurity attacks. You mentioned that the Biden administration has, you know, an executive order in place, but this isn't new to this administration. Why does it kind of feel like we've been a little slow to address this on a federal level?
Well, part of the problem is that the federal government is in general pretty slow to react to high tech threats, if you will, evolving threats. This is a bureaucracy and apparatus that does not have a lot of tech savvy people. Certainly across the agencies, there are very smart cybersecurity experts. But overall, that a lot of the leaders and a lot of the mid-level people did not sort of come of age and enter government at a time at the current time where this is really at the forefront. This is a bureaucracy that has been slow, partly because it's just not used to these threats. The other piece of it is this is not an issue that we can solve with U.S. policy alone. A lot of these criminals are operating out of Russia. The Kremlin does not seem to have any interest in cracking down on them. And so the best thing that we can do, if we can't convince Russia to arrest these people, frankly, and oftentimes they're not breaking Russian laws, so Vladimir Putin doesn't have that much of a reason to arrest them. If we can't do that, all we can do is focus on increasing the resilience, the defensiveness of our companies. And that's a huge challenge because the government has been very reluctant to regulate the security of private companies, at least the cybersecurity of them. And so what we're left with is kind of the voluntary approach. Please upgrade. Please patch your systems. Please use a strong password. All these kinds of things that you and I understand are important. But companies are first and foremost focused on profit. And it's been a long slog to get boards of directors to understand that this could be a really important issue for them and that, you know, they have a fiduciary responsibility to protect their company, if for no other reason than for the sake of their share price.
We are talking to Eric Geller right now, cybersecurity reporter at Politico, and we are talking about the latest cyber attack that took place over the holiday weekend and really how the federal government is responding to it. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you taken steps to protect your data? What would you like to see from the government in terms of how they address these cybersecurity hacks? Do you feel confident that this is something that can be addressed on a large scale? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we will continue this conversation coming up in just a minute right here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we continue our talk with Eric Geller. He covers cybersecurity for Politico, and we are talking about the rise in ransomware attacks and what solutions we could see on the horizon from the federal government working with private companies. You can join the conversation right now by calling 800-642-1234. Now, before we took a break, we were talking about how, you know, in Russia, what some of these cybersecurity hackers do isn't against the law, and that, you know, moving forward, we might need maybe a diplomatic approach to dealing with this on an international level. Do you think we could see something from Washington, D.C., where we work more closely with other governments to prevent attacks like this?
Yeah, certainly that's something that top Biden officials have stressed, especially in the past few days, is they want to work with other countries to put pressure on especially the companies that run these cryptocurrency exchanges, these virtual currency websites. And hackers often, almost always, ask for ransoms in, you know, Bitcoin or another type of cryptocurrency. And that money, just like, you know, American dollars, has to transfer through some kind of institution. And so you have these cryptocurrency companies, these exchanges that facilitate these payments, not necessarily willingly, but they certainly could be doing more to crack down on them. And what President Biden has said is we're going to ask our allies to mount a concerted effort to get these companies to do more, to know what, you know, what entities are using their platforms. There's this concept called know your customer, which is basically saying if you facilitate financial transactions, you need to make sure that criminals, terrorists are not using your website for that purpose. Right now, we haven't really seen a lot of companies lean hard into that concept, but it's possible that as more international pressure is applied, that we might start to see some of that.
So at least 17 countries have been affected. This Revil group is asking for $70 million in cryptocurrency, like you just mentioned. And it seems like cryptocurrency is becoming the ransom, the currency of choice for many of these hackers. You know, why cryptocurrency?
Well, it is harder to track. It involves more technology that can obfuscate, you know, where the money is going. I mean, one of the wonders of cryptocurrency is supposed to be that it is built on this platform that lets you see all the transactions. You know, there's this digital sort of ledger that you can use to follow the money. But it's hard to follow exactly where the money is going and the exact increments in which it is flowing. And it's also hard to intercept it, again, unless you have the participation of the cryptocurrency exchange, because you've got these passwords that people use for their accounts. They've got these keys that only they know. And unless the company has a way to intercept that money, it's not like, you know, working with a major, you know, U.S. regulated bank, for example, where they've been dealing with money laundering for a very long time and they have systems in place to intercept money and return it if it's stolen. The cryptocurrency exchanges, you know, by comparison, are kind of the Wild West. And so that is why it's an attractive platform for criminals.
And as part of the ransom, Revil is asking for that Bitcoin ransom, $70 million in Bitcoin. And what they're going to hand over is a decryptor key. Can you explain what that is for people who might not be familiar?
Yeah, so a decryptor key is essentially the magic solution to unlock your files and let you use them again. So the ransomware attack involves scrambling your files so that they're all gibberish. You can't access them. And the hacker group will create a tool that undoes that process. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. We saw with Colonial that it actually didn't fully work, and they had to restore some of their data by using versions of the files that they had backed up themselves. Sometimes security experts are able to actually design their own tools, so they can provide those to companies that have not yet paid, and they can say, here you go, you can unlock your files with this. But this is basically what the hackers are holding out as the magic solution. Pay us and you can have your files back by running this piece of software.
We are talking to Eric Geller right now, cybersecurity reporter at Politico. And I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Mike in Brookfield. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm just curious why this wouldn't be a very good place to create a department within the Department of Defense where the budgetary needs for something like this, because on a mass scale that this would cost to basically defend, would have to be something almost like a Department of Defense budgetary item. And then the budget, you know, that, or then the Defense Department has so many ties to places like the CIA and the FBI and different agencies throughout the government. It just seems like creating a cybersecurity defense force would make practical sense and would have the budgetary earmarks pretty much, I would imagine, sail through Congress in order to fund a program like this.
Mike, thank you so much for that that call and that question. What are your thoughts, Eric?
Well, part of the challenge here is that, you know, cyber attacks are very different from other kinds of attacks that the military is structured to defend us against, in that there's just a blizzard of them happening at all times. So it's hard for me to imagine a part of the military, a defense force that is structured to actually protect businesses on an ongoing basis. We do have inside the military U.S. Cyber Command, which is responsible for protecting the military's own networks and also for conducting what most people would colloquially call cyber war. But there's really no capacity within the federal government to actually provide the kind of digital defense on a regular basis that we imagine the military providing in the physical world, or that we imagine, you know, police or the FBI providing in the physical world. You know, another part of that is a lot of what the federal government does on cybersecurity happens after the fact. DHS does a lot to provide guidance so that businesses can protect themselves and not get hacked. But a lot of the resources go towards, after there's an attack, going in and helping you recover your data, helping you figure out who hacked you. It's not clear to me or to a lot of the experts that I talk to that you could build a program to actually do that proactively for the entire private sector.
Do you think we could start seeing some more of that? I don't want to call it proactive at this point, but do you think that this could really light a fire under people to develop better systems, develop better practices to make sure that we can stop some of these attacks before they start?
I do think that, especially with the actions that President Biden has mandated in his executive order about applying the absolute lowest hanging fruit, stronger passwords, moving to building your computer networks through something called zero trust, which means you assume that people are already on your network and you try to design everything so that they have a hard time jumping from one computer to another. These basic ideas that experts have been recommending for years, once more federal agencies start doing those things, it's going to trickle out to the private sector. We're already seeing, of course, many businesses, especially large ones, are already doing these things. But the question is, how do you get it to the level of the small or medium-sized business? And how do you get it to someone like SolarWinds or Kaseya, which may be a large company, maybe an incredibly important company, but is not a famous company? It's not getting a lot of public pressure to be secure. It's kind of in the background, and we don't hear about it until something like this happens. How do you get that kind of company to proactively pay attention to security? I think it starts to happen when the federal government takes it more seriously on its own.
Now, you cover cybersecurity policy for Politico. We've been talking about kind of these independent actors or organizations that are taking part in these cybersecurity attacks. But we also touched a little bit on the fact that there are state-sanctioned groups that participate in cyber attacks. How do you see policy evolving moving forward to deal with those that state-sanctioned work that I also know that the United States is also doing to some degree?
Yeah, that's harder to prevent because, you know, we can't say, you know, Russia, China, you need to stop spying on us. You need to stop hacking our defense contractors and our federal agencies to gain information about us, because we, of course, do that too. So we have some moral authority with respect to ransomware, you know, criminal groups. We don't really have any way to push for an international consensus against a SolarWinds type of attack, where that was largely aimed at infiltrating federal networks and spying on specific federal officials. We do that kind of thing all the time. That's really an area where if we want to stop that, we can't tell Russia that they have to stop doing it. We just have to make it harder for them to succeed. And that goes back to the basics that I talked about earlier.
And in our last minute or so, what will you be watching for as, you know, this story continues to unfold? But also, what are you just keeping your eyes on in the future?
So the biggest thing is probably, is Congress going to require companies to alert the government when they've been hacked? The federal government does not know about a lot of hacks, and DHS says that makes it harder for them to protect the country. So there's some House and Senate legislation being drafted right now, and I'll be curious to see if that gets enough support to pass.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Eric Geller is a cybersecurity reporter for Politico, and he covers federal cyber policy issues, and he broke down what we know about the latest global cybersecurity attack, that one that hit a private company. They exploited a patchwork in their code and really disrupted about 1,500 businesses across the globe. Now, coming up, we'll hear about an island in New York State that is being returned to the Stockbridge Muncie community here in Wisconsin. And we are also going to talk about news coming out of the Olympics right now about Sha'Carri Richardson. That is the sprinter that in a recent drug test tested positive for marijuana. And now she will not be participating with the American track and field team. We will be talking about that coming up in just a moment right here on Central Time. And of course, you can keep the conversation going on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We earlier talked about camping in Wisconsin and how to convince people to get out there and camp. You can add your comments there. Again, that is the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. I'm in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, sprinter Sha'Carri Richardson will not be on the U.S. relay team for the Tokyo Olympics after a drug test revealed that she had cannabis in her system. We learn more about the rule that banned her and why many of Richardson's supporters say the rule is not fair. Now, the Stockbridge Muncie Community Band of Mohican Indians has its seat of government in Wisconsin, but the community's original home territory is in New York State. Earlier this year, a piece of that ancestral land was returned to the Stockbridge Muncie community. Pepskani Island has been saved from development as a nature preserve and will now be operated by the Mohican Nation. Heather Bruegel is the Director of Cultural Affairs for the Stockbridge Muncie community. She's an enrolled citizen of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin and a first-line descendant of Stockbridge Muncie. I spoke with her about the news this afternoon. So first off, can you tell us a little bit about the Pepskani Island and the history it has with the Stockbridge Muncie community?
Yeah, so Pepskani Island is extremely significant in our Mohican history as it was the home of one of our sachems or leaders, Sachem Pepskani, and he would have been a leader of Mohican Nation in the late 1600s and was, you know, there when we, you know, first were encountering removals.
And basically, if I have my history correct, the Stockbridge Muncie community there in the 1600s, they encountered Dutch colonists. They were under the impression that this was land preservation that they were doing with the Dutch colonists, and that wasn't what the Dutch expected and took over the land. Is that correct?
Yeah, so our first encounter with the colonists was in 1609 when Henry Hudson came sailing down what we call the Mahicanatuck, which is the river that flows both ways. And from that moment on, you know, life for a Mohican nation changed completely through the inception of trade or, you know, being removed from various locations. It was not what we thought was going to be a reciprocal relationship. Very much ended up turning to a one side with, you know, colonists forcing removal of indigenous nations and, you know, us having to be removed from our homelands.
This island is in what we now know as New York State. And the Stockbridge Munsee Mohican Nation seat of government right now is here in Wisconsin. Can you tell us how members of the Mohican Nation ultimately ended up being forced from their homelands, coming from New York to Wisconsin?
Yeah, absolutely. So from the time we were forced out of the Mahicanatuck River Valley, our seat of government moved to Stockbridge, Massachusetts. And from Stockbridge, Massachusetts, in the Berkshires, which is part of our ancestral homeland, from there we were forced westward through various agreements or treaties that were made. We had, you know, we did spend a little bit of time in White River, Indiana. And then from there we moved to Kaukauna, Wisconsin, then Stockbridge, Wisconsin, and then finally through the Treaty of 1856, from land that was ceded from the Menominee and Ho-Chunk Nations, we moved to present-day Shawnee County, and our reservation encompassed two townships, the townships of Red Springs and Bartlemy. And from that moment on, from 1856 on, that is where we have been located.
We're talking to Heather Bruegel right now. She's the Director of Cultural Affairs for the Stockbridge Munsee community here in Wisconsin. And we're talking about an island that has been returned to that community, a historic island in ancestral lands. Now, Heather, let's talk about the physical island itself. From what I know, it's remained relatively unchanged. Can you describe what it's like there?
Yeah, absolutely. So through the great stewardship of Open Space Institute, Patskinny Island was virtually saved from any forms of development or anything that was going on there. In the 90s, Open Space Institute came in and bought the island to help protect it and were stewards of it up until just recently when ownership of the island was handed over to the Stockbridge Munsee community. They, you know, were very grateful to Open Space Institute and what they did because the island is, as you said, it's virtually untouched. There is some development on one side of the island that is just like agricultural development. But on the other side, it is as it would have been possibly when Patskinny was alive, you know, virtually untouched with that, you know, just natural vegetation, natural wildlife. I know it is, you know, a great place where people like to go hiking and through the walking trails. And so that's something that will remain. But other than that, the island is basically untouched and is as it would have been when Patskinny was alive.
Now, how did you mentioned the organization that has been stewarding the land since the 90s, but how did the land then change hands from that organization to you all?
You know, it was through a series of negotiations. It was something that they had brought to us that, you know, we worked with in our community, within our land department. And because we are not in our homelands anymore, there was the issue of managing the island and who was going to help steward it since we were not going to be able to be there. And so we are working with Rensselaer County and who continue to maintain the walking trails and things like that. They will continue to have the day-to-day functions of it, but it's under our management. And so they're kind of there to assist us in anything that we need. And so, you know, when Open Space Institute first brought the idea to us, it was something that we, you know, definitely thought about very hard and very long and figured out what would be the best in order to manage this island while not physically being there, but having a space that we can, you know, finally call ours and our homelands again.
Yeah, and sticking with that last point, what does it mean to the Stockbridge-Munsee community to have this piece of land back?
It's so important and it's so significant. This piece of land, I think, to anybody else is just a really pretty place where you can, you know, go for a nice walk. But to us, there's so much meaning behind that land. Know that this land is someplace where we know factually that one of our ancestors walked on, lived on, you know, saw over Mohican Nation from. And it's so important that we're able to honor that history and to honor our ancestors by continuing to be stewards of lands in our homelands.
Heather, we have to leave it there for now, but thank you so much for chatting with us about this today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me today.
Heather Bruegel is the Director of Cultural Affairs for the Stockbridge-Munsee community. She's an enrolled citizen of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin and a first-line descendant of Stockbridge-Munsee. She talked with us today about a piece of Mohican Nation's homeland in New York State, the Papaskani Island Nature Reserve, being returned to the community earlier this year. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a conversation between a father and daughter about their military service.
Like her father before her, Alice Bechdahl joined the U.S. Army as a family tradition. Growing up in a military family helped make that decision pretty easy. She currently serves as a logistician who ensures that equipment and people are where they need to be exactly when they need to be there. She spoke with her father, John Bechdahl of Middleton, about the differences in their experiences and the tradition of serving as a family.
My name is Alice Bechdahl. I am 30 years old. I am currently in Washington, D.C., and I am doing an interview with my father, John Bechdahl.
I'm 54 years old, and I'm located in Middleton, Wisconsin. I enlisted in the National Guard the summer right after high school, started college, and then I went on active duty right after graduation. Spent 22 years on active duty in the Army as a field artillery officer.
I joined the military through Army ROTC at Wisconsin. Upon graduation, commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Ordnance Corps. Later, when I became a captain, transitioned to the logistics branch. So I've been in the military for over 8 years.
When I first joined, it was a different animal. Back during the Cold War, we were facing the Soviet Union. The Army was largely an unforgiving place. I mean, my particular branch, if you made a mistake, you know, when computing firing data or something like that, that you were done. How would you compare that to the atmosphere you found when you went on active duty?
As a second lieutenant, I think you're just kind of scared and nervous and want to do the right by everything. But as a logistician, though, it was very different. It was okay to make mistakes, but you needed to learn from them. And it was how you reacted to those mistakes, which kind of defined you as a soldier or as a leader in the Army.
I was really impressed that you chose that particular field to go into.
I think that's funny you say that, because I feel like my whole life has been prepping to be a logistician, being your kid and being an Army brat. There is so much change that we have to encounter. I mean, whether it's making sure that I'm prepped for that next stage of our life as a family, or whether it's balancing between soccer practices, school, all the extracurricular activities, I've always felt like it's taught me to really think about what I need and not take anything for granted, which might not be available to me later. So I think as a logistician, like, I'm always thinking about what the other person might need, because I want to be able to provide it for them so that they don't have to go back and try to get something else.
That never occurred to me. The fact that we made you move 9 times in service, that being preparation for being a logistician.
Yeah.
That never occurred to me. That's very insightful. I'm very proud that you chose to go in the service. On my father's side, you know, my dad was in the Marine Corps in World War II. His dad fought in the Spanish-American War, 1901. Your mom's father was in the Air Force. So there's a tradition there, not necessarily of career people. I was kind of the first career person. I don't know if you plan to do a full 20 years, and that's completely up to you. But I think you've done great in the service, and Mom and I are very proud to have our blue star up in the window.
Oh, thanks, Dad. Yeah, it's kind of surreal with having the lineage that we do in our family. I don't know if it's anything that we've ever, I don't think the calling, I think it's more of just the motivation to give back. I feel like that's just kind of the incentive going all the way back, or just something that's we've always just kept in our family for hundreds of years. And then however they met between your side and mom's side, but the able to give back and think of the larger picture and what's good for all, being able to talk about that is pretty amazing.
That was Alice Bechdahl of Washington, D.C., and John Bechdahl of Middleton, Wisconsin. They shared their experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
Coming up, we'll learn more about the decision to keep sprinter Sha'Carri Richardson off the U.S. Olympic team after she tested positive for cannabis in a recent drug test. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Sprinter Sha'Carri Richardson will not compete in the Tokyo Olympics this month. That's after a drug test showed that she tested positive for THC, a chemical found in marijuana. Richardson has apologized and said that she used the drug while dealing with the death of her biological mother. Here's what she had to say on NBC last week.
As much as I'm disappointed, I know that when I swim on the track, I don't represent myself. I represent a community that has shown me great support, great love. And to y'all, I failed y'all. And so I apologize for the fact that I didn't know how to control my emotions or deal with my emotions during that time.
But some health experts say marijuana is not a performance-enhancing drug, and they're asking why U.S. anti-doping officials still test for it at all. Nellie Drew is a professor of practice and sports law at the University of Buffalo's School of Law. Nellie, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So why do we see the U.S. anti-doping agency still test for a substance like marijuana?
Well, because it's still banned internationally under WADA, the World Anti-Doping Association, and as part of that, you know, that international community, those are the rules as they stand currently.
You know, are there any other non-performance enhancing drugs that are banned by anti-doping officials?
There are a number of substances of abuse, which is what they refer to as items that are used outside of the context of sport. And by what they mean by that is essentially a situation in which the substance does not affect sport performance. It's not taken typically as a means of improving performance or gaining a competitive advantage.
Now, Sha'Carri Richardson took, we don't know how, but she used cannabis in Oregon where it is legal. She was dealing with the news that she learned from a reporter that her biological mother had died. You know, for lay people, it seems like there were some extenuating circumstances and she was in a state where it was legal. Why didn't that fly or maybe even garner her some sympathy?
Yeah, Jay, you know, these are the hard ones, right? Because you feel empathy for her. And I really am impressed by how she, you know, stood up and said, yeah, I did it. I'm sorry. I apologize. And she really was very, very mature in how she handled the situation, which makes it, I guess, somewhat harder to accept it. But to give you an example, again, I mean, whether there are two separate discussions going on here, right? One is whether the World Anti-Doping Agency needs to review its list of banned substances again and think about whether or not, you know, THC should be on it. But the second piece, of course, is that their method of operation is what we call in the legal world strict liability. And what that means is liability without fault. It doesn't matter how, why, when, what the circumstances might have been, how extenuating they might have been. If it's in your body, you are responsible and you are subject to punishment. And to give you an example of the difficulty that, you know, USA Track and Field faced, just on June 3rd, there was another athlete, Kamari Montgomery, who did the exact same thing and received the same penalty.
Now, one of the things that has also come out is, you know, this anti-doping committee gave Sha'Carri Richardson a 30-day ban. So she might have actually been able to go with the U.S. relay team. The U.S. relay team had some discretionary spots. They could have chosen her, and they opted not to. Do we have a sense as to why they might have not?
Yeah, so they explained that they had already notified the athletes who were going to be participating in the relay. They had announced the team numbers, and they just did not think that it was fair. That they expressed, you know, concern for Sha'Carri and empathy for her situation, but they said that they just did not think it would be fair to the other athletes that they had already notified that they were going to participate to essentially withdraw and substitute one of them and substitute her instead.
We are talking to Nellie Drew right now. She's a professor of practice in sports law at the University of Buffalo School of Law. She's with us to talk about the news surrounding sprinter Sha'Carri Richardson, who will not be representing the United States on the track and field team because a drug test found that she had THC in her system. THC, of course, is from marijuana. The United States has sort of a piecemeal laws dealing with marijuana at the federal level. It is banned state by state. Of course, we have some leeway. We don't have anything that's uniform in many ways. It's legal in Oregon, but in some states, it's legal for medical consumption. You know, do you think that this sort of piecemeal law may have made everything just a little bit harder here as these anti-doping committees, you know, grapple with marijuana usage?
Yes, it's a very interesting conversation, especially because there is some evidence that it, particularly in sports where concussion is an issue, it may actually have some therapeutic effects. So it's a very interesting conversation we're seeing going forward. The challenge is that, you know, WADA, the USADA, the four major professional sports leagues, USA Track and Field are all private associations. And what that means is they are subject to their own rules that they create on their own behalf. And they can certainly impose restrictions above and beyond what might be permitted under state law.
You know, is this something that it's just a U.S. issue, or have we seen similar marijuana, cannabis usage issues come from other parts of the world? There's obviously the parts of the Netherlands where it's legal. Do we have anything at the international level that you're aware of?
Well, certainly, again, it's subject to nationally generated law. And the struggle that WADA has is, again, trying to impose this code across athletes from around the world with very differing approaches to all kinds of different substances. As I'm sure you can appreciate, the laws vary from country to country, just like they do here from state to state. So that, in part, is why WADA has adopted this strict liability approach. And I will say this, WADA has bent over backwards in some respects in terms of trying to provide as much information as possible to the athletes so that they are aware of what is and is not prohibited by the code.
Sentiment is changing. As we've talked about, some states have adopted marijuana laws, and it feels like there is some pressure on anti-doping officials to maybe change the ban. Do you think we're likely to see that anytime soon? Certainly not for the Tokyo Olympics this summer.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how this evolves. No, it won't happen this summer for sure. That's way too close a window. But the four major professional sports leagues are starting down that road. They're having those conversations. I will tell you that each of the four handles the subject of marijuana somewhat differently. The NBA has a specific policy for it, which is very, very lenient, shall we say. And I think this conversation will continue. Ultimately, you know, how long it will take to get to the point where WADA revisits the code. Maybe this is the case that instigates that review.
And WADA, for those listeners out there, is the World Anti-Doping Agency. Do you have a sense of what, if they were to maybe change the rules, what that process would look like?
It would be a lengthy one. It would require a lot of informed discussion. It's a challenging question for sure. And I will tell you that, you know, in the world collectively bargained professional sports, the list, the contents of the banned or prohibited substances list is often very much a discussion for debate and collective bargaining negotiations. Now, of course, these athletes are not unionized, but similar discussions will occur at the level of WADA as well. They'll examine relevant scientific evidence. They may very well consider the impact that athletes have as role models for others in the community. We'll see where that conversation goes, but I strongly suspect we'll see it happening sooner rather than later.
And in the last maybe 30 seconds that we have, what will you be watching for next?
I guess I'll be looking to see what happens with athletes who may test positive in competition at the Olympics in Tokyo. That would be very interesting. Yeah. And as you may know, there were some challenges with the drug testing labs in various other locations previous Olympics. So the folks will be on the lab in Tokyo to make sure that they do a good job.
All right, Nelly, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Nelly Drew. She's a professor of practice and sports law at the University of Buffalo's School of Law. She was with us today to talk about Sha'Carri Richardson's suspension from competing and why U.S. anti-doping officials prohibit the use of marijuana. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we will get the latest in political news out of Washington on our weekly check-in on Week in Washington. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. This is Central Time.
Thank you to the donors who make Wisconsin Public Radio possible. There are more than 50,000 of you. Your generosity delivers essential news, thought-provoking conversations, and inspiring music to listeners all over Wisconsin and beyond. Your support makes a difference in people's lives every day. Thank you.